Infinite Mind.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting on location, and I'd like to welcome you. Today, we're going to start with the latest on health and healing from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. They have a new study about how magnesium is the perfect supplement for fibromyalgia sufferers. Then I'm going to give you an unusual quote you have not heard before, and let's see if anyone in the audience can determine who made the quote. And if you can guess that, please call us on our talkback number at 888-874-4888. Then we're going to share some insights that we shared yesterday. However, a lot of people were listening from our land-based and syndicated stations to the show that we did with Abby Martin that we got very positive feedback on. So you missed the Mary Holland, the professor of international law, talking about how we do have treaty rights that supersede all federal and state rights when it comes to protecting the sanctity of our body and not having our body used in any form of way against our own personal judgment authority, meaning we're not giving informed consent, so you have no right as the state or federal government to do it since international treaties protect us. I'm going to play both segments again. I didn't get to the second segment at all yesterday. I didn't even finish the first segment. So it's going to be a total of 16 minutes. And this is a really important issue that we have shared with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., at least six other major attorneys in the field helping vaccine resistors, and also two other constitutional attorneys, and they're experts, they're top. One was at Harvard Law Review, constitutional attorney. We've spoken with them in depth. They all believe that that should be the next place we go. And so we're advocating that and helping support that legislation or that that lawsuit. So I'll let you know more about it. So there's still hope that we, the people, will win against the pharmaceutical industry and its shills in state and federal legislatures that want to mandate vaccines purely for profit. It has nothing to do with science. Also, Greta Thunberg lectured to Congress yesterday, and it was a lecture because she does not bear fools well. And she says, you know, I want you to listen to the scientists. Well, the trouble is they're not, and no one's doing anything about it. So we're going to play her segment, and I did a special commentary yesterday on Greta, and I'm going to redo it today, but I'm going to stop as I do it and show why it's relevant for everyone in this audience. So in effect, if you heard yesterday's program, then this is an abbreviation of that commentary. We begin always with the latest on health and healing. And if you're looking for a natural approach to effectively relieve the painful and exhausting symptoms of fibromyalgia, which is pain in your muscles, taking magnesium is a great way to deal with chronic conditions of pain. And while the primary cause of fibromyalgia you may not be able to understand because pain comes for many different reasons, one way that we can help keep people off of the opiates and the toxic pain medication, both over-the-counter and prescription, is with magnesium. In fact, I would have to list magnesium and cat's claw as the two best for dealing with pain. But also, magnesium protects against strokes and corrects neurotransmitter imbalances in your brain. Therefore, it's great for people with depression and anxiety conditions. It's terrific for young people with ADHD. and it's good for seizures. So magnesium plays many different roles, especially in supporting brain health. It enables crucial enzyme-based processes and acts as a vasodilator. That means it's increasing the flow of blood into your brain. And the mineral also protects the brain from the harmful effects of calcium and glutamate. In particular, magnesium deficiency increases the risk of depression and is linked to an onset of neurological degeneration and cell death. And the average American diet is grossly deficient in magnesium. Conversely, higher levels of magnesium help reduce the risk of a stroke. So when I read this study from researchers at the Karolinska Institute, they evaluated the risk of stroke in a large cohort of smokers, and some of the participants took magnesium supplements, others stuck to a regular diet. And the researchers found a really significant correlation between those that took magnesium, those that didn't, as far as the incidence of stroke. It prevented strokes. So there's something easy, non-toxic, natural, no side effects. And it can also, at the same time, help with memory gaps, help if people are having trouble concentrating on tasks, and helping to smooth out erratic moods like depression and anxiety. So it's all good, all the way around there. And it also helps to mineralize bones and normalize blood glucose levels. So it is a superstar. And magnesium citrate, C-I-T-R-A-T-E, that would be the one that I would recommend. From Pusan National University in South Korea, they're treating overactive bladder, which a lot of people have, with moxibustion. Now, moxi, M-O-X-I, bustion, that's an old external treatment. I'm sure you've seen it, even if you didn't fully understand it. It's been used in traditional Chinese medicine. It involves the burning of dried herbs, like mugwort or wormwood, on top of an acupuncture needle or over a layer of ginger or even salt placed on the skin. Now, based upon the biometric analysis on studies conducted from 1954 to 2007 in China, this alternative therapy can treat 364 different kinds of ailments, including urinary tract symptoms. And in a recent study published in the journal Medicine, researchers from Pusan National University in South Korea explored the efficacy and safety of moxibustion in treating overactive bladder. And by the way, overactive bladder it's not just one thing. It's a group of urinary symptoms characterized by incontinence in the absence of urinary tract infection. And the researchers reported that moxibustion can improve the symptoms of overactive bladder and that its effects last for about 4 weeks. And it can be used to alleviate these symptoms. So, and the main type of moxibustion commonly practiced today is indirect moxibustion. And what I mean is that it's a technique that can be applied in different ways by burning moxa, a substance made from dried herbs, on top of the acupuncture needle, as I mentioned, and applying heat to acupuncture points using an electrical source, or holding a burning moxa directly above the skin for several minutes. And the other less common type of moxibustion is direct moxibustion, which involves placing a burning moxa directly on the skin. And this technique is longer and used because it can cause pain and scarring, so it's not one that I recommend. But this was an actual randomized control crossover access blinded trial study showed that it works. So there's another ancient healing technique that works, but never try it yourself. That's why you go to a licensed acupuncturist or therapist to get that done. From Suzhou Children's Hospital in China comes a study that was presented at the annual European Society of Pediatric Endocrinology that shows that probiotics, those are your good bacteria, can enhance weight loss in obese children. It's that simple. And it makes sense. It simply bring the intellectual coupling issues together. Why are children overweight? Well, the majority of children are overweight because they're consuming more calories than what the body is burning. It's also true for adults. So if you know that you have an excess of calories, what kind of calories do you normally have? More often than not, the calories are from refined carbohydrates, saturated fats, and excess protein, the common American diet. But also, all of those foods have something else in common. From sugar to alcohol, from hamburgers to french fries, from pizzas to colas, they all upset the normal microbiota, the normal bacteria, and they take them from a healthy state to a toxic state. Therefore, when children are obese and they're overgrowing their body's capacity to maintain their equilibrium, they end up with heart disease and type 2 diabetes and debilitating complications. But probiotics, which are live microorganisms, and they have enormous health benefit in restoring the diversity of our gut bacteria, also called microbiome. So when you hear the word good bacteria and microbiome, it's one and the same. Although some studies have reported benefits of probiotic consumption for health and weight loss in adults, its effectiveness has not been studied as much as in children. So they did a study on 6 to 14-year-olds, and all the participants were following a reduced caloric diet and an exercise regime, and then they took the probiotics. And those that took the probiotics had remarkably more benefits. So just get your probiotics into your child and help them with a healthier diet. University of Washington study questions the value of fluoride varnishing. Now, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's advertised. Fluoride varnishing has become a popular anti-cavity treatment for children. And it's relatively easy to apply, and not just for dentists or dental hygienists. Pediatricians can do it as well. With relatively minimal instruction. They take a sticky varnish that goes on with a brush and then dries in a few hours. And it's not like taking a supplement, which they shouldn't take. No child should take a fluoride supplement, or having gels that the child can swallow. And it's very cheap. The general treatment runs about $25 to $30. And therefore, the child's teeth are supposed to be protected. However, a new study by two University of Washington researchers and their colleagues says, hold on a second, that fluoride varnish that you're now marketing to preschoolers and calling it anti-cavity has uncertain outcomes. And therefore, there's no conclusive proof that it actually works. Now, they reviewed 20 clinical trials in 13 countries and didn't find that there was much of a benefit, so I would not use it. From the University of New South Wales, which is in Australia, researchers have found links between junk food consumption and loss of spatial memory. That's interesting. This is a laboratory study. So what it means is unhealthy eating can have negative long-term effects for spatial memory. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Scientific Reports. It investigated cognitive function in the laboratory and rats that alternated between cafeteria diets of foods high in fat and sugar, like pies and cakes and biscuits and chips, and their regular healthy diet. And over a period of 6 weeks, the junk food diet was extremely destructive, causing spatial memory and recognition deterioration in increments. Now, why is this important from my perspective? Because I have done as much as I can do with one nursing home operator, providing him with all that would be required for a, let's say, a senior citizen at the last stages of life who are no longer capable of taking care of themselves, so they've been put into a nursing home. And I want to know everything about the care of the nursing home. Do they keep them strapped in chairs and medicated all day? And and where they can't tell a person if they're hungry or thirsty, and they frequently die of dehydration or they die of malnutrition. It's a national scandal, and it doesn't matter how expensive the place is. Remember, places are expensive. They're expensive for one reason only. They have something that differentiates them that a person is willing to pay for, with the presumption, which is purely illusionary, you're going to get something extra or better or special, when that's far from the truth. But in this case, because they want that profit to go into their pockets. So in this case, I saw what the institution was willing to do to forego the typical kind of junk food that all these institutions have, institutional foods, and give them healthy diets. And that's based upon some senior citizens that I was working with, who, when I took them off with their family, who came to me, it was the family, I didn't know the people, and the people didn't know me, but their children did, and their children were in their 50s and 60s, and mom and dad were, you know, no longer able to take care of themselves. But then when I would do in-depth discussions, I found that mom and dad had terrible diets, didn't exercise, smoked, drank. So the medical community said, well, this is the normal outcome of aging. And I said, no, it's not. You're wrong. You're absolutely wrong. Now, they had only the moniker of authority in medicine. They study disease. They treat disease symptoms. Ask your average doctor, when was the last time you were able to cure arthritis? When was the last time a psychologist cured depression? They don't. And we all know that. And it's not because they're not trying or not sincere, don't want to. I believe they absolutely would love to see their patients improve. But the trouble is they were indoctrinated into using protocols that are only there for symptomatic relief and are not actually getting at the root cause of what caused the person's conditions and how to reverse those conditions, because that would be a different protocol. And they're not going to risk, the majority are not going to risk going to a different protocol, even if it would work. So when you take a look at a person's debilitation, especially an older, have to understand what you're seeing in the moment. You're seeing someone whose eyes are glazy and they're drooling and they're looking at the ceiling and they're incoherent, they've lost cognition. You're not seeing something that is in that moment being caused by something recent. You're seeing a lifetime of improper choices leading to that moment where the body tips and can no longer maintain homeostasis or balance. You can rebalance that. It's just there's no model existing in medicine or in science. Trust me, I just had a long conversation with some scientists about what is necessary. And when I told them even partial what was necessary, they said, well, no one's going to do that. That's impossible. I said, well, they said you couldn't break the four-minute mile and Bannister broke it. He was right. They were wrong. All the engineers and scientists in the world who believe the body couldn't run faster than a four-minute, they were wrong. And then he created a new paradigm. Well, I believe that we're at a place where we can challenge the old paradigm, because I've seen so many people, when you change the medium, you change the environment, you change the protocols, you change their biochemistry. And therefore, an older person in a nursing home could come right back out of that nursing home, right back into life. Think of that. Now, some don't want to think of that. Well, you know, think of what that will do. No, I'm just talking about on a purely spiritual and humanistic level. If we could bring a person who is near death back to being fully engaged in life, that's what's important. I remember there was a famous artist. His name was Paul Swan, and he was an interesting character. He had one of the most phenomenal lives, and I'm young, naive, and not terribly bright, and I'm sitting in his studio because his pianist, Richard, was a friend of mine. And I'd never met him. I didn't know who he was. And this was a recital. And And Richard didn't tell me a whole lot about him. Just said, I think you'll find this interesting. You want to go down now, and I'm going to play a piano for this guy to do this dancing recital. I said, sure. So I went down, and it was the Van Dyke Studios down on, I think it was 50, around 55th, 56th Street and 8th Avenue. And he had been at Carnegie Hall for over 40 years, this Paul Swan. And the whole room was filled with older women. There wasn't a man in there. I mean, it was packed. And they were all dressed up, and this perfume was over the whole room. I told Richard, I said, Richard, I'm going to go outside until you start, then I'll come back in, because I think they just they drank the perfume, and it's coming out their pores. This is just overwhelming. So anyhow, I heard the piano, and then I opened the door, and this old hand comes out, and it's shaking, and it starts to pull back the curtain, and suddenly it reveals this very old man with lots of makeup on. And I'm thinking, whoa. But then it was as if he transformed into this supple and graceful and unique artist. And he was playing Candida. And no, it was a Narcissist. And I watched this, and he was just flawless. It was just perfect perfection. I mean, it couldn't have been better. Anyhow, afterwards, I read the write-up in the Daily News and gave him a lot of credit. And then when I started looking afterwards, when everyone had left, and these older women had been his followers since the 1920s. They were in their 80s and 90s. And I'm watching. He's got white bread and peanut butter and jelly, and that was his dinner. So, and he had all kinds of health problems, and I said, would you like to improve your health? He said, yeah. So I went to help him out and gave him a whole new diet. And he wasn't good at, you know, he didn't have a kitchen. He'd go across the street to the deli every day and bring back terrible food. So every day I'd go down and I'd make him fresh juices and make him a lunch and make him a dinner. And I gave it to him, Richard would get on one of the others. And over a period of 6 months to a year, then using proper supplementation, all of his conditions reversed. It was like he had de-aged by 20 years. His pain, his vision improved, his energy. And one night I'm sitting there, and he's painting under a skylight. It was raining outside, and there was just one light above, coming across his back onto the canvas. And I thought, wow, I'm going to remember this moment, because here's this Renaissance painter, dancer, sculptor. This is a man who had been with Gertrude Stein and D.H. Lawrence and T.S. Eliot and all the great artists in Paris at their salons. And how rare is it to have a chance in life as a young, naive kid that I was to be in the presence of someone so unique. I've never forgotten that whole moment. But it brings back the idea that, yeah, had there not been an intervention, he probably would live an extra year. But his body was collapsing, even though his mind and his desire to continue with life was still vibrant. So I believe we're at the beginning of what could be a major, major shifting in our consciousness of how we age, how we die, and where it is now absolute that dying is inevitable, but how we die is under a lot of our own control. And science and medicine and society doesn't believe that. Excuse me, they believe that, well, you know, their number's up, it's time, they've lived a good life. They're 65 years old. They're half their biological age. So we're looking at things a little differently now. Hopefully within 90 days, or about 100 days from now, I'll be able to present some hard biological scientific evidence that it is possible. Remember, once you show it's possible, then watch all the other people jump in the field saying, yeah, let's do something. Because if we could extend people's quality of life, help them overcome disease, wouldn't that be worth it? I believe so. I believe people are sacred and deserve a chance. at Living Another Day. From the Salk Institute for Biological Studies comes a new study about how, well, in California it's called the holy herb. I'm sure you've heard of it. Herbasante, Yerbasanta. Now, the Salk Institute has found that it's good for dementia and aging. And therefore, researchers are really interested in this because it can help as a natural treatment for Alzheimer's. Yeah, an herb. And in their study, which was published in the peer-reviewed journal Redox Biology, they found that Herbasante, a plant native to California, contains an active compound called Sterubin, S-T-E-R-U-B-I-N, that could be used to treat people with Alzheimer's. And the herb, which is the Spanish for holy herb, is highly regarded as a medicine for respiratory disease, bruising, fever, headaches, infections, and pain. Now, there was an earlier study. The same team of researchers used a screening method to identify plant compounds that could reduce inflammation and protect nerve cells. And from this, they developed a screening tool that can both identify compounds that might protect cells, but also find the target pathways of these compounds. And for the current study, they first examined 400 plant extracts with no medicinal properties for their ability to prevent oxytocin. That's a kind of cell death that occurs in Alzheimer's disease in the hippocampal nerve cells. And that's what they found. So good news, new information for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. One last study here from the Medical University of Vienna, which is in Austria. In fact, this was also done in cooperation with the European Association for the Study of Diabetes and in Barcelona, Spain, at the university. They found that there's a very strong link between vitamin D deficiency, when you don't have enough, and an increase in death, especially diabetes-related deaths. So here's the takeaway message. If you don't have enough of the vitamin D in your body and you're diabetic, you can die sooner. All right? That's the latest in health and healing. We're 27 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Nall on location. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to play the two segments for all the people in this audience, the thousands of people over the last 6 months that have called myself or Luann and said, what do I do? They're not allowing my child into school because it's not getting vaccinated. Well, Professor Mary Holland and a group of constitutional scholars believe that we have a potential challenge, legal challenge for them. So you'll hear Professor Mary Holland uninterrupted for 16 minutes when we return. Please stay with us.
Mary Holland. She's a research scholar at New York University School of Law. Ms. Holland, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. I want to start by asking a couple simple questions to be answered by a show of hands. How many of you have ever, for any reason, been critical of the United Nations? Security Council, peacekeepers, budget issues come to mind. I see a lot of hands. Okay, and how many of you have ever been critical of the United States for any reason? Foreign policy, domestic policy, primary elections, right? So we're here at the UN, we're in the United States, but the vast majority of us have been critical of these institutions at one time or another. To me, this is like asking, are you alive? Are you breathing? Are you a thinking person? It is human and normal to be critical. almost all of us have been critical at some point, because these are complex institutions with varying actions and inactions all the time. But now, if I ask you, have you ever been critical of your country's vaccine policies? You may be reluctant to raise your hand, and for good reason, because in the supercharged public discourse about vaccines, were you to answer, yes, I have been critical of some aspect of vaccine policy at some time, you would likely be branded anti-vaccine, that fundamentalist boogeyman term, and not by a militant or fringe publication or spokesperson. You might be branded anti-vaccine by the likes of the New York Times, the New England Journal of Medicine, the World Health Organization, and by spokespeople from National Centers for Disease Control and National Pediatric Associations. Your views on vaccines might be considered outside the mainstream and equivalent to the views of those who deny climate change. You might be considered, as I have sometimes been, a flat earther. No matter if your critiques were categorical or that you truly oppose all vaccines for all people at all times, or if you simply believe, as many people here and I do, that mercury should never be a preservative in any vaccine anywhere in the world because there are better and safer alternatives. Many in this, thank you. Many in this audience here today are branded anti-vaccine, although that is a gross distortion. We are called this primarily to marginalize and dismiss our views. But just as most of you are critical of some aspects of the UN and of the US, but think that they are important institutions, most of us have views that are nuanced, pro-health, and pro-safe, affordable, necessary, and effective vaccines, or sane vaccines. So my focus today is on the role of law in protecting human rights when it comes to vaccines. How can we balance the rights of the collective versus the rights of the individual? Vaccines, by their very nature, are a population-based medical intervention. If enough people take this medical intervention, then the so-called herd will be protected from the circulation of a communicable disease based on the theory of herd immunity. Although individuals receive vaccines, the rationale for vaccines is for the good of the individual and the society. One of the core purposes of the United Nations, set forth in Article 1 of its Charter, is to achieve international cooperation in promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms of all. So the UN and the international community have obligations to respect human rights related to vaccination. But how must nations and the UN do this? This is an important question that deserves scrutiny, as it profoundly affects both individual and public health. Since World War II, the international community has recognized the grave dangers in involuntary scientific and medical experimentation on human subjects. In the aftermath of Nazi medical atrocities, the world affirmed the Nuremberg Code, which stated that the voluntary consent of human subjects is absolutely essential. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights further enshrined this prohibition against involuntary experimentation, stating, "No one shall be subjected without his free consent to medical or scientific experimentation." Such a prohibition is now universally recognized, so that some courts and scholars have pronounced the right to informed consent as a matter of customary international law. In other words, it applies everywhere, whether or not a country has it on its books. It's the same as the norms prohibiting slavery, genocide, torture, and piracy. But what about informed consent in the area of treatment, including preventive treatments like vaccines? This is a controversial issue today in many countries, including the United States. In 2005, the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, addressed this issue, adopting the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights, based on a consensus of 193 countries, including the United States. The participating countries hoped that this declaration, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights before it, would become a set of guiding principles. On the issue of consent, the declaration states, "Any preventive medical intervention is only to be carried out with the prior, free, and informed consent of the person concerned, based on adequate information." It further notes that the sole interest of science or society is not sufficient. This pronouncement is the extension of the medical oath attributed to Hippocrates 2,500 years ago, that doctors must work for the good of their patients and never do harm. Abbreviated as the first do no harm principle, this credo embodies the precautionary principle in medicine, clearly placing the interests of individual patients above the interests of the collective or so-called herd. This precautionary principle leads directly to the view that vaccination policies must be recommended, not coerced. The doctor-patient relationship depends first and foremost on trust, and coercion undermines it. When the doctor-patient relationship is based on coercion, trust is a casualty, and doctors then serve the state, and by extension the society, above their individual patients. This is a slippery slope where civilized medicine has too often derailed in the past. Dr. Leo Alexander, the chief U.S. medical consultant to the Nuremberg trials, warned in 1949 that from small beginnings, the values of an entire society may be subverted. He pointed out that long before Nazis came to power in Germany, a cultural shift in the medical community had, quote, already paved the way for adoption of a utilitarian, Hegelian point of view, with literature on the euthanasia and extermination of those with disabilities as early as 1931. Following the medical precautionary principle, the default position for vaccination must be recommendations, not compulsion. Individuals for themselves and their minor children should have the right to accept or refuse the preventive medical interventions based on adequate information and without coercion, such as the threat of loss of economic or educational benefits. Informed consent must be the default position because compulsion on its face not only undermines trust, but limits the fundamental rights to life, liberty, bodily integrity, informed consent, privacy, and parental decision making. Many developed countries' vaccination policies embody this principle of childhood vaccination recommendations, including conference co-sponsors Germany and Japan. Other developed countries that achieve impressive public health without resort to compulsion include the United Kingdom, Australia, Austria, Denmark, Iceland, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, South Korea, and Spain, among others. Nonetheless, the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights does permit limitations of fundamental rights, but these limits must be imposed by law and must be, quote, for the protection of public health or the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. Furthermore, any such law needs to be consistent with international human rights law. International courts have developed a test to assess whether restrictions of fundamental rights are legitimate and lawful. The test studies whether a measure is lawful, strictly necessary, and proportionate to the risk. The state enacting the restriction bears the burden of proof that the compulsory medical intervention is lawful, strictly necessary, and proportionate. Generally, strict necessity must be the least restrictive alternative to achieve the public health objective, and non-coercive approaches must be considered first. Thus, the state must show that a less restrictive alternative is not feasible before adopting a highly restrictive or coercive one. In addition to these criteria, if a state does mandate vaccination, then it has an affirmative obligation to provide an effective remedy for those who have been injured as a result. Like all prescription drugs, vaccines carry the risk of injury and death to some. The guarantee of an effective remedy is a basic pillar of the rule of law in a democratic society, and the remedy must actually be an effective one. It can't be an illusory remedy, which in fact provides no relief. Vaccination policies have changed drastically since the early 20th century, when they were primarily emergency medical interventions for whole populations in times of smallpox outbreaks, to the policies of today, when they primarily target infants and young children for non-emergency prevention of many diseases of varying severity. Legislatures and courts have had to grapple with many issues flowing from these policies, including vaccine injury compensation, religious exemptions, philosophical exemptions, the right to education, the right to informed consent, and the right to parental decision making. I provide a few examples of court decisions related to vaccination from courts in different countries. In Japan, in 1992, the Tokyo High Court heard a case from 159 survivors of vaccine-induced injury or death. the court concluded that the Ministry of Health had been negligent in failing to establish a screening program to exclude people with contraindications to vaccination. The court noted that the Ministry of Health had focused on measures to raise vaccination rates at the expense of attention to vaccine adverse reactions. Furthermore, the court noted that the ministry had not provided sufficient information about vaccine adverse events to doctors and the public. The court concluded that the injured victims were entitled to compensation as a matter of state policy. In Ukraine, in 2004, its constitutional court interpreted the Constitution to guarantee the right of education on the principle of equality, and it found that every child was entitled to a school-based education regardless of their vaccination status. The Turkish Constitutional Court in 2015 upheld the principle of parental consent and that it was necessary for the vaccination of children and infants. It found that despite the Ministry of Health's assurance that childhood vaccinations are in the best interest of the child, the infant's interest in bodily integrity may only be violated for medical necessity and based on law. And that was not the case for routine vaccinations. On the other hand, in January 2015, a judgment of the Czech Constitutional Court upheld a public health law prohibiting young children from attending school, preschool, without vaccinations against 9 diseases unless the children had permanent contraindications. But the judgment was over a stinging dissent, arguing that the court's decision was more politically motivated than based on a rigorous constitutional analysis. The dissent found that the majority's decision had turned a blind eye to the unconstitutionality of the law, and that the court's decision would ultimately undermine rather than advance the legitimacy of vaccination mandates. In the United States, the legitimacy of school vaccination mandates came into sharp focus last year when almost 20 states introduced legislation to limit or prohibit altogether exemptions from vaccination except for very limited medical ones. Only in the state of California did blanket legislation pass, which prohibits all exemptions save limited medical ones, although similar laws already exist in 2 other states, Mississippi and West Virginia, to that effect. We are likely to see in the near future whether California courts will uphold or reject this new law, which directly contradicts the California Constitution's guarantee of a right to a public education for all children. We will see whether courts are prepared to endorse a new kind of school segregation against 225,000 children whose vaccination statuses do not conform perfectly to California's dictates. With over 270 vaccines in the global research and development pipeline, the role of law and courts in upholding or rejecting vaccination mandates and in compensating the victims of vaccine injury is critical. As we all understand, healthcare is a big business the world over, and vaccines represent a growing medical market with increasingly high profit margins. If we don't adhere to first principles of the rights to life, liberty, and bodily integrity of the individual, and the right to prior, free, and informed consent in medicine, we may find ourselves with both known and unknown harms. To conclude, I paraphrase President Eisenhower's farewell address to the United States in 1961 when he was addressing the benefits and risks posed by the military-industrial complex. I substitute the term medical-industrial complex, which I believe today poses many of the same benefits and risks. He foretold, "The potential of the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this complex endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and medical machinery of health with our methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. In holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. So let us be alert, knowledgeable, and properly integrate the interests of global health security and global liberty. Thank you."
That was Professor Mary Holland. She made it very clear. We have independently confirmed with 2 other constitutional specialists and scholars that there is every reason to accept that the Nuremberg judgments and the subsequent treaties that the United States was signatory to shows that treaties are higher in ranking and have greater authority than state or national laws. It's just that no one has sued in that area yet, and they should have. Now I believe that the lawsuits will commence, and I'm hopeful that Robert F. Kennedy's group will commence those lawsuits. I told you I wanted to see if anyone could understand who made this quote, and it says the following. In our dream of the elite, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own good will upon a grateful and responsive royal folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or of science. We are not to raise up among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambitions to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply, end quote. Know who that was? Because it had a lot of influence on a lot of people. If you do know who that is, give us a shout out at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and Alex will give me the name, your name, and the name you think gave that. In the interim, we're going to play you another clip. This is from yesterday, from Congress, where Greta Thunberg, that's Thunberg, the young Sweden representative on climate issues, and she's had all the doors of the world open to her, from the Pope to President Obama, former President Obama had a photo op with her, to doing a whole presentation between Davos, the British Parliament, the French Parliament, the Irish, and the United States Congress, and the United Nations. Now, next week, I'll be addressing the issue of how's that possible? How could a 16-year-old, when she started 17 only now, how could she open all these doors when, if you know how these things work, it just doesn't happen? I'll give you the backstory next week as I've been able to uncover it. But now let's hear what she has to say. This is Greta Thunberg talking yesterday to Congress.
I have not come to offer any prepared remarks at this hearing. I am instead attaching my testimony. It is the IPCC Special Report on Global Warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, the SR 1.5, which was released on October 8, 2018. I am submitting this report as my testimony because I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. And I want you to unite behind the science. And then I want you to take real action.
Ms. Thunberg, let me ask you a question. If you're sailing across the ocean and you're picking up trash along the way, and for every one piece of trash that you pick up, there's a boat right next to you dumping out five pieces, how would that make you feel?
If you use that logic, then I am also dumping a lot of trash in the ocean. And then I would stop dumping my trash in the ocean and tell the other boat to stop dumping their trash in the ocean as well.
Some people say that the United States should not dramatically reduce our emissions because China and other countries aren't doing enough. I'd like to have your view on that and have each of the witnesses comment on that briefly.
I am from Sweden, it's a small country, and there it is the same argument. Why should we do anything? Just look at the U.S., they say. So just so you know, that is being used against you as well. As it is now, people in general don't seem to be very aware of the actual science and the how severe this crisis actually is. So I just think we need to inform them and start treating this crisis like like the existential emergency it is, then I think people will understand and want to do something about it.
Certainly support her, and we support all of the people, young people, teenagers who've taken today off, and the million people who've been allowed out of school. But this is just the first step. And what does it say about us as a society, my generation, who were the people who motivated for always having something more and we thought better? And indeed, many of the things we have today are better than what we've had in the past. And a lot of things are actually compounding the problems and making everything worse. So what responsibility does the average baby boomer, the average senior citizen have in looking at a lifetime, even though ethically and morally lived and at a high standard? But when we look at what we've eaten, what we've purchased, how we've disposed of it, how we've adapted ourselves to everything that modern living says that we should have in our lives, and what a mess that is. And the young people are now just being awakened by her and the movement in the United States today. They need tools, and some of those tools are in the form of videos and articles. Richard Gale and I have written 16 articles. Now, these are not simple little articles. These are very detailed articles about the problems with our environment, and they're all fully footnoted. You could put them into a scientific publication. Indeed, they have been shared by hundreds of different websites around the world. And we have shared them all with Greta, and she's gotten them. And the commentary I did on her yesterday, she also got. So we're happy that she has all of her information, plus three documentaries, and we've posted them on PRN.fm. So you too could go there, download them, read them, and then take even highlight the points that you want to focus on, and then share that with everyone you can, and then become a part of that process. Because at some point, it's not about having governments intervene. Right now, we have governments intervening in all the wrong ways. They're intervening in Venezuela, and shame on Bernie Sanders. And thanks to Mitchell Cohen and a few people pointed this out, and I'm going to do this on our next program. I'm going to play you Bernie Sanders saying how, you know, the United States should, you know, remove Maduro. Well, you're talking about intervention in a country, and he was democratically elected, like him or not. He may be corrupt, but the Venezuelan people are not, and you're going to destroy them for what, expanding American hegemony? Bernie should be smarter than that. On some issues, he just doesn't seem to get it or understands it, and that's playing to the military-industrial complex. In any case, when you look at how many people are connected to the causes of pollution, it's not China. America is still the number one polluter in the world. The United States military is the largest single polluter on the planet. What has been done to even lessen their budget? Nothing. All the presidential candidates that are legislators, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, all supported increasing the budget and paying for this huge, huge budget, $1.4 trillion, $700 billion above board, and the rest of additional expenditures. And we don't need even one-tenth of that. One-tenth of that. And look what we could do to ghettoize, de-ghettoize the environment. Plant trees. Go off monocrops. Clean up our rivers. Help clean up the ocean. Deacidify the ocean. There's so many things we had the technology and skill to do, and not a single effort's being made. We're not planting a single tree in the United States. Bangladesh is planting tens of millions of trees. So when we look around the world, the countries that are most adversely affected by global warming are producing the least carbon and methane, and yet they're being devastated. So her message and all of the messages today are correct. We must do more, but we have to do it at the individual level. The government of the United States is so captured, every one of its agencies, all of its politicians. Your state legislators are captured by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has written and had passed into law over 27,000 bills, including the current vaccine-mandated bills. And the Democrats, unfortunately, are the ones leading the charge for more government at every level of our lives. What happened to them? My God, those of us who grew up liberal and in some cases very, very much to the humanistic level of liberal are ashamed of what corporate liberalism has become today. It's a bubonic plague. And it's no better than the Republicans. They've always been a bubonic plague. It's just that get away from thinking the government's going to come in and protect you. They're not. They're the problem. Or the corporations are going to change overnight. They're not. Or that we're going to give up all of our buses and trains and planes and travel and cars that use fossil fuel in the next 10 years. Never going to happen. Or that we're going to green the planet the way we say because we're going to throw money at it. It won't happen. The way it does happen, however, is the way anything happens. You start with a committed group of individuals who are fully educated on the topic, who are completely informed by intent, and therefore in their own personal lives begin to make that change. Like going vegan, not buying things they don't need, buying things that can be recycled, giving things that instead of throwing away in obsolescence, if it can be used, use it. Give it someone else to use. And buying locally grown organic food instead of genetically modified food. Think before you buy that hardwood furniture. Where did the hardwood come from? What forest was just devastated? I put a picture up this week, and you really ought to see it. It's one of those pictures that's going to sear into your mind. Here's just thousands of acres, all the trees cut down to put in palm trees for palm oil in Indonesia, one of the most corrupt places on earth, where you can buy any politicians for nothing. And here's one single tree. And up in the tree on one single branch is the last orangutan, a pregnant female, malnourished. And down below is a sniper about to kill her. That's the world we live in today. That's the reality. Trust no politician on any level. They're pathologically dysfunctional when it comes to actually caring about the people. They care about themselves. So I'm glad to see that the kids are out today. It's unfortunate adults have to take a lesson from teenagers. Does it say something rather ironic that an entire world has to be reminded of what it should do and what it has not done properly for decades by, at that time, a 16-year-old Swedish young girl? Wow. And we're really difficult in our country at all levels to change anything, especially if it creates discomfort. But we're going to try because we do believe that we can make a difference. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.